So first, I'd like to introduce Dr. Daniel Miller. He's a very long affiliation with the camel business. I think he was born in the he was educated in the Cape Town, South Africa, and now is honorary research professor at the University of Tasmania. And he worked quite a lot with the marine resources, biology, policy, management, and conservation issue. He is now the executive secretary of CAMLA, and he was the SCAR group of specialists on certain ocean ecology, and also chair of CAMLA too. And he also worked as a chair of United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization in some in one regional body of fisheries. So I'd like to introduce first Dr. Daniel Miller for his talk on the sustainable management in the Southern Ocean, CAMLA science. Dr. Miller, please.
Well, thank you and good afternoon, everybody, and thank you to the Treaty Summit board for inviting me here, not as a CAMLA representative, but as someone who's not yet forgotten what CAMLA set out to do. I'm probably the last man standing in that organization. So this is my swan song, as they would say. Hopefully I'll give you some insights, particularly the insights into what science actually means in the context of the remit that's been handed to CAMLA, and that is the management, the rational utilization of the resources within the CAMLA area south of the polar front, which was alluded to by Tucker Scully yesterday. The treaty as a system, as a whole, is actually replete with references to science. You look, for example, in the preamble, the according of the interests of science and the progress of all mankind. You look at Article 2, the freedom of scientific investigation in the Antarctic. And Article 3, the international cooperation in scientific investigation. But most importantly, Article 10.1f actually indicates the need to provide the preservation and conservation of living resources in Antarctica in the context of measures in the furtherance of the principle and the objectives of the treaty. And in those words lies the birth of CAMLA. And those words were developed in a little more operational and practical sense in the Seals Convention, the 1972 Convention on the Conservation of Antarctic Seals, which promotes and achieves the objectives of protection, scientific study, and rational use, that term of rational use, of Antarctic seals, and to maintain a satisfactory balance within the ecological system. These were principles that would be that were, in terms of sustainable management of marine living resources, were unheard of at that time in history. And this was taken further in Antarctic in the ATCM meeting of 1975, the 8th Antarctic Treaty Consultative Meeting, which actually set out the bones of what was to become the CAMLA Convention, and that is to promote and achieve within the framework of the Antarctic Treaty the objectives of protection, scientific study, and rational use of Antarctic marine living resources. And as Tucker indicated yesterday, this was largely predicated by the concern that there had been unsustainable harvesting practices in the treaty area and in the Antarctic and Southern Ocean more widely that had not really been sustainable. And in particular, certain finfish species had been exploited in the late 1970s, the late 1970s. There was the emergence of the krill fishery in the early 1970s. And that concern with the development of a potentially very large fishery on the Antarctic krill and the standing of Antarctic krill at the center of the Antarctic system, a marine ecosystem, were really the causes of concern and the reasons, the driving force for the Camelot Convention. Now, there were a couple of considerations that I just want to highlight before I have a look at this in a case study. And in the paper that is attached to this, I go into this into a lot more detail. So what you're going to get now is very, very potted, very personal, and very hopefully abbreviated. And I'm never known for my ability to abbreviate anything, but hopefully abbreviated appreciation of some of the case studies and some of the successes and challenges that Camelot has faced over the past 28 years. The first point I want to make was the system as a whole was not as pristine as everyone would like to make it. And if you look from the beginning of the 1950s, we've heard today about the depletion of ozone. Are you looking at air temperature changes, springtime ozone towards the late 1950s and early 1960s, going into right into the 70s, the sea ice area decreasing. These were changes that happened through time, but manifestly and most directly linked to Camelot in its intent were obviously, and I've already alluded to some of these, commercial fishing, where you saw the decline of some of the major stocks, particularly in the West Atlantic of the Antarctic cod, and further to the east around Kerguelen of the same species, Notothenia rossii, and of course the whale fishery, which peaked towards the end of the late 1930s, bit of a break during the war, and then really got into its own in terms of depletion thereon after post-war and the setting up of the International Whaling Commission in 1946. So that's the first point. This had to be grappled with in setting the ground rules for where, how Camelot was going to operate. The second point was that Camelot really had a challenge, and it had to balance conservation with rational use. And as Tucker indicated yesterday, conservation was set out by some very key principles, and I'll talk to those in a moment. But essentially, these were at the basis of management action. These required a precautionary and an ecosystem approach. The first thing was the spread of the fishery. Very vast area, 32 million square kilometres, similar size to the North Atlantic. And the second are the time and space challenges that go with this. Management decisions are normally taken within a space of about a year. Shipbuilding and the economics of a fishery may be anything from 1 to 5 years, maybe even longer. Changes in the predator stocks, remember, being ecosystem-based, anything that was to be undertaken in terms of harvesting was not to affect predators. You have a situation there where these may be, in the case of Camelot, will put us 2 to 3 decades, 20 to 30 years. And this is a very, very complicated mix, and there has to be a way of diluting this down into manageable components that actually have a practical and achievable sense. So this required that the objectives of the treaty, of the convention, needed to be, if you like, broken down and looked at. And this is what Article 2 of the Camelot Convention does in terms of managing harvesting and associated activities. First was to prevent the decrease in the size of any harvested population. This is the management of a single species, if you will. So to ensure that that is its ability to procreate in the future is not compromised. Maintain the balance of the relationships between the harvested and dependent and related species. And restore any populations that were depleted. And we still have not restored the Antarctic cod populations. And 30 years later, and prevent or minimize the risks of changes that are not reversible within 2 to 3 decades. So this was, again, a little bit linked to the rebuilding of some of the whale stocks, but certainly was to say for some of the longer-lived species that we needed to operationalize what this might in fact entail in terms of our management approach. So it then became the place, in particular with respect to Article 9 of the Convention, that the best scientific evidence available needed to be taken into account in setting up the management regime and implying management decisions. And also, we needed to have a view, a systematically identified and programmed view of what actually we were looking at. What could we manage and what couldn't we manage? And of course, some of these are mentioned in Article 2, but others are not. And there's a very complicated mix here, a mix of climate, if you like, natural changes, mixes of scale and time, interannual natural variability, which I've already referred to, ecological events, extreme events, and come back to these in a moment, the effects of species that move from place to place, the economics that is driving exploitation, and the politics that links the extended area to the Antarctic polar front of the Kamalar Convention with that of the treaty. So in terms of the action, what Kamalar did was to set out a set of scientifically formulated operational objectives and decision rules. For each of these elements, the harvested species, the restored population species, and the ecosystem. And it dealt with these in a systematic way. The harvested species was precautionary catch limits and effort controls. The fish, with the restoration of depleted species, populations, fisheries closures by bycatch limits. The ecosystem had set up the Kamalar ecosystem monitoring program and various modeling approaches. Looked after my bycatch mitigation, looked after environmental protection. And we go on to, in recent times, I'll come back to these, looking on vulnerable marine ecosystems on the sea floor and looked on the issue of protecting marine biodiversity through marine protected areas. Although you will not hear that term commonly banded around in the Kamalar circles. These were all aimed at minimizing the risk of irreversible change. And using a series of scientifically formulated models on projections, stock projections, feedback management action, and guidance of decisions through a systematically monitoring, scientifically based monitoring program led back to a formulating of a feedback and a dynamic loop in the management approach and action. Major problem of the krill fishery was that in the development of this fishery, it soon became apparent there were things going on that will always influence this fishery. And for example, if you look at this stock trend, if you look at these catches trends, you'll see when the EEZs were starting to be proclaimed in the 1970s, there was a drop off in the total catches of finfish. Initially, were very high in the Kamalar area as fishing vessels were displaced into the area. These dropped off with the proclamation, fishing down on the stocks. You got the growth in the interest of the krill fishery, which largely drives the fisheries. The dissolution of the Soviet Union led to an operational reduction in the fishery. The development of illegal, unreported and unregulated fishery led to a slight spike initially in the Atlantic Ocean and the Indian Ocean, and the development now of new kinds of technology for catching krill have indicated that we are starting to see a growth in that fishery in particular. So in terms of managing the krill fishery, and this is, if you like, the looking at the harvested species and the most important harvested species in terms of the ecological context, we've had the successes of a precautionary modeling approach to assessing yield and to managing the actual fishery itself through a krill yield model and a general yield model. But we haven't managed to apply these in smaller areas other than regionally defined areas. The areas of overlap between predators and prey, for example, at critical times. We've not really got that into our management processes yet. We have decision trigger rules, but we haven't really been able to use the data collected by the Kamalar Ecosystem Monitoring Program in our management advice. We've tried to limit catches prior to the fishery expansion, such as the krill fishery, but we haven't been able to do that because we haven't been able to disaggregate those catch allowances as of yet, although we have the only precautionary catch measures of any international organization in place. And we need to, we've looked at the defining areas better, but we haven't had the acquired economic data for independent forecasting of the fisheries growth. And these have all been somewhat problematical. Now, the Camelot Ecosystem Monitoring Program has been set up to detect changes in critical components of the system. And it has set up a series of sites and species throughout the Antarctic to work as indices of what may be happening in the system. Now, obviously, the program has got to then try and link these possibly to natural effects and to effects that may be happening as a consequence of fishing. And there is the challenge. We have found, for example, that there's interannual variability in the some of the species concerned in their population numbers and particularly in their reproductive outputs. We've also found that this appears to be linked to years of low krill availability. This is all science and monitoring that Camelot has done. We have noticed that since we've been collecting records on krill and from the fishery and indeed from more directed research, that there's an increasing frequency of the years of low krill in a temporal sequence. But this, we know that there's dynamic variability in not only in the krill fishery, as you will, but there's dynamic decadal variability in some of the predator populations with time. And this is largely not as a consequence of fishing. It's largely as a consequence of other environmental effects. But the management process has to tease out what is caused by fishing and what isn't. So in those terms, bringing the ecosystem components together, we have to move rather, as I indicated earlier, to larger areas into what we call small-scale management units, SSMUs, where the components of the system, fishery, predators, and prey, are likely to overlap in time or space. And we have to do that in the context of the activity of fishing itself, the context that there is a global reality. Some of the species breeding in the Camelot area move out of that area and are affected elsewhere. For example, an animal like a grey-headed albatross migrates over considerable areas, and it also moves through a large number of regional fisheries management organizations' jurisdiction globally. And that many of these species are impacted directly by tuna fisheries to the north of the Camelot area, in areas outside Camelot's control. And of all the activities, if you like, management activities, not necessarily scientific activities, but managing and monitoring activities which are complementary to the science, the overlap with the mitigation of bycatch from longline fisheries is a Camelot success story. But we've started to look at new challenges. The challenge of biodiversity protection. 11 areas have been identified within the Camelot area that are representative of the various, biotypes in the area that have the components of the fishery included. And that it's been recognized that there is a need to afford some form of differential management, either total protection or scheduled fishing in those areas. And the very first one of those has been protected area has been proclaimed for biodiversity protection this year at the South Auckland. So with a minute to go, I've got to summarize this, puts it all together. As I said, this is a pretty substantial history and you got it really quickly. The first thing is we have a model system. This herendogram, as I like to call it, basically says simply is that there's a whole lot of time and space interactions that are incredibly complex and require scientific definition. That we really can't do very much about the ecosystem realm. That's going to happen. But we can do something about the management realm in terms of looking at the interactions in time and space between the vessels and the fishing fleets and the animals concerned, if we have some basic knowledge. And bringing that knowledge together in a way that confines the uncertainty is really what we are grappling with. We have to develop and apply within the scientific, with scientific rigor and evaluate a structure and a function for the ecosystem about which we have incomplete knowledge. We have to have measures that we can apply and use and monitor in terms of input and output controls, in terms of protected areas and protected times. And we've had to look at the management process, make it participatory within the spirit of the treaty, and have to make sure that our assessment methods are robust, rigorous, and repeatable. And we've had to do this all in the scenario of a dialogue looking at scientific uncertainty and the possibility of risks attached to such uncertainty. And that dialogue is very important, and I hope something we can develop in the panel discussion. And finally, we have to realize that there is fisheries development and social input that we require. And in those terms, I would say, if you're going to have a punchline, a soundbite, Camelot science is the observation, identification, description, experimental investigation, and theoretical explanation of phenomena so that scientific evidence is used equitably and with sustainable management. If you don't have the scientific evidence of sufficient standard, your management will fail. If you don't manage of sufficient standard, you will never get that scientific evidence. Thank you.
On behalf of the International Advisory Board, I give a present medal for you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.